Alice Coote singing Mahler's Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen. A kiss from Vladimir Yurovsky, principal conductor of the London Philharmonic Orchestra, as Coote moves to the front of the stage, bows to the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall, and the orchestra now stand behind her. Upon the road, there stands a linden tree, where for the first time I slept at peace. Under the linden tree, which snowed its blossom upon me, I knew no more of life's travail. All was well again, all. Love and sorrow, the world and dreams. Text by Mahler himself, written after the rejection he'd encountered. He fell in love with a singer at the opera house in Kassel in Germany. Alice Coote now back on stage alone this time. As I mentioned, featured artist in this 2012 season of the BBC Proms. Truly now an international performer. She'll be singing Leonora in La Favorita at the Champs-Élysées in Paris next season. Sextus in Julius Caesar for the Metropolitan Opera in New York. The Rocket Leader coming up at the Barbican, and Berlioz's Les Nuits d'Été in Chicago under Sir Mark Elder. Is with Mark Elder, a great supporter of Alice Coote, that she performed the Apostles here at the Proms last week. Back on the platform now with Yurovsky. Mahler wrote the Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen with piano accompaniment first between 1883 and 1885 while he was working in Kassel. Later, several of its ideas were used in the First Symphony. And then he orchestrated the songs in the early 1890s, a decade after he'd first written them. Even then, though, he kept on tinkering, and the songs didn't reach their final form until 1897, when they were published. Well, the year that Mahler completed the first version of the Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen, Tchaikovsky wrote his great work Manfred, a symphony in four scenes after a dramatic poem by Byron. We're going to hear the work in 20 minutes' time here on Radio 3, after the interval in which we join Matthew Sweet and his guests for today's Proms Plus Literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, across the road from us, here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Hello. As you listen, there's an unseemly rush for the bars at the Royal Albert Hall. It's all elbows and requests for gin. But we're going to spend the interval doing something much more civilised. We're going to get a reading list from one of this country's biggest opera stars. She's Christine Rice, the mezzo-soprano who became cinema's first 3D Carmen, who was the first Ariadne to brave the horns of Harrison Birtwistle's Minotaur, and who played the role of the Israelite man in this year's Proms production of Judas Maccabeus. Not the first time that she's changed gender for the sake of her art. In this programme, she'll be sharing her literary passions and revealing how they reflect her life and her music. And I'm pleased to say that an equally powerful voice, that of the actor Andrew Wincott, will be bringing them into being. Chris, first let's get some sense of the place of literature in your life. In what circumstances would we find you reading a book?
Well, I do lots of travelling. So having a family, I don't read much at home. But when I go away for work and I'm in a hotel by myself, then I have a quiet read.
We should probably reveal at the start of this programme that you and I have known each other since we were 16 years old.
We're going to own up to that, aren't we?
So I've been looking at Christine's bookshelves for 26 years now. And the first extract that you've chosen is something that connects with your pre-operatic life, I think.
Yes. Well, this was Bill Bryson's A Short History of Nearly Everything. It was a totally fantastic read for me because it was published at a time when I had already physics behind and moved into music. And so it just sort of refreshed all that and got all those neurons firing again. And it's an absolutely superb book from the science point of view.
Okay, Andrew, let's hear something from it.
When the skies are clear and the moon is not too bright, the Reverend Robert Evans, a quiet and cheerful man, lugs a bulky telescope onto the back sun deck of his home in the Blue Mountains of Australia, about 80 kilometers west of Sydney, and does an extraordinary thing. He looks deep into the past and finds dying stars. Looking into the past is, of course, the easy part. Glance at the night sky, and what you see is history, and lots of it. Not the stars as they are now, but as they were when their light left them. For all we know, the North Star, our faithful companion, might actually have burned out last January, or in 1854, or at any time since the 14th century, and news of it just hasn't reached us yet. The best we can ever say, is that it was still burning on this date 680 years ago. Stars die all the time. What Bob Evans does better than anyone else who has ever tried is spot these moments of celestial farewell. By day, Evans is a kindly and now semi-retired minister in the Uniting Church in Australia, who does a bit of locum work and researches the history of 19th century religious movements. By night, he is, in his unassuming way, a titan of the skies. He hunts supernovae.
Thank you. So, Christine, that's an account of the life scientific. Do you miss that life? You were going to be a physicist, weren't you?
Yeah, I missed the science. When I reread this book, it was so dense with fascinating information and the connections that scientists made. What I also thought it was did absolutely brilliantly was show the struggle that the scientist goes through, and particularly between colleagues. There's some very spicy stories of backstabbing and rivalry. Reading that, I understood why for me, science was not the career choice.
It feels quite an unusual switch to make. I mean, do you remember the moment when you realised that you had a voice that was powerful enough to allow you to leave one world and enter another?
No, I think because when I went to music college, I had made no assumptions that it would be a career change. I mean, I purely had come to the end of my journey with science and where I was happy to sort of take it, and I was looking for something else. And I decided to give myself a year to think and do something else in that year. So it was very much a kind of sidestep, not a definite sort of career choice. And I was very lucky to meet a fantastic singing teacher when I was at music college, and that changed my life.
And is this sense of wonder that we get of that kind of scientific endeavour, is that something that, I mean, is there a parallel to that in the world of music? Does it press some of the same buttons for you?
Oh, I mean, most definitely. If only you think of what the composers have done, the achievement there. No, you sit on the concert platform, you reach the end of a piece, and you know, it's spine tingling.
Let's move on to your next choice, which is something from a great cycle of novels produced in the Edwardian period.
Yes, I absolutely loved all of the Forsyth saga. There's 9 books in total, and I could have picked any of the 9 books, but I thought if this was a recommendation, then people should start at the beginning. So I chose A Man of Property.
Okay, let's hear something from that, Andrew.
Soames Forsyth could not understand what his wife found wrong with him. It was not as if he drank. Did he run into debt, or gamble, or swear? Was he violent? Were his friends rackety? Did he stay out at night? On the contrary, the profound, subdued aversion which he felt in his wife was a mystery to him and a source of the most terrible irritation. That she had made a mistake and did not love him, had tried to love him and could not love him, was obviously no reason. He that could imagine so outlandish a cause for his wife's not getting on with him was certainly no Forsyth. Soames was forced, therefore, to set the blame entirely down to his wife. He had never met a woman so capable of inspiring affection. They could not go anywhere without his seeing how all the men were attracted by her. Their looks, manners, voices betrayed it. Her behavior under his attention had been beyond reproach. That she was one of those women, not too common in the Anglo-Saxon race, born to be loved and to love, who, when not loving, were not living, had certainly never even occurred to him. Her power of attraction he regarded as part of her value, as his property. But it made him indeed suspect that she could give as well as receive, and she gave him nothing. "Then why did she marry me?" was his continual thought.
Thank you, Andrew. I find it really easy to imagine the Forsyth saga as some enormous opera cycle. It could be our Ring, couldn't it, if somebody put their name to it?
Yes, yes. Particularly this relationship between Soames and Irene. There's so much rage and frustration on his side and this sort of passivity that she presents. Whereas, as you get to know her better, she's very deeply feeling. But of course, within the book, you don't experience her directly. She's indirectly written about. You only see her through other people's eyes.
Is she like an opera heroine to any extent?
She wouldn't get many of her own arias, would she? she is this sort of, you know, often cast as sopranos, I shall say, without rather huffily, but the soprano character is always this untouchable beauty, a woman, you know, ripe for loving and often thwarted in love.
So she's certainly a soprano part then, if we...
I think she's a soprano,
what's
yes.
The difference in terms of the sensibility of the singer, do you think, between a mezzo and a soprano?
Well, I think there's a silveriness to the soprano voice. I mean, obviously, you get a range of sopranos and you get the heavier, more dramatic ones. But in terms of a stark difference between soprano and mezzo, then the mezzo voice is a warmer, more yielding sound, often given to older characters, perhaps the more kind of sexually open.
So it's a sexier kind of voice then. Sexier roles go with this voice.
Well, yeah, it's more permissive.
Well, Carmen would be a fantastic example of that.
Carmen.
Wouldn't she?
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen you play her on stage with fantastic gouts of blood spraying everywhere.
Yes, yes, a good death. That's what you want with Carmen.
And on the cinema screen too, in 3D.
In 3D. The very thought.
Tell us about that experience.
Actually, that was remarkable because they had these huge cameras taking up most of the stalls and a track with a camera going along at the front, sometimes between you and the conductor. So it was very, very present, the filming, whereas normally when they film for television, the cameras are at the back and it's discreet and you're just there with the audience. So it was much more noticeable. But even then with that, they melted away. Whilst you concentrate on your job, you're busy telling a story and you cease to notice them. And I thought the end result was fantastic because I do think that when you film an art form like opera or ballet, there is an element that's lost, and that helped to regain some of it.
Let's move on to the next extract, which is from work by Sebastian Foulkes.
Yes.
Why have you chosen this one?
This is Human Traces, and I found it a very beautiful and deeply moving book. Again, actually, it has quite a heavy science content to it. And it is about two scientists and their endeavours in life.
Andrew, let's hear from it.
When Daniel was 6, he had been taught in school about St. Valentine and under the mistress's instruction made a coloured card for his love. He drew on it a picture of flowers in a bunch and inside, again with the teacher's help, wrote, "Dear Mummy, be my Valentine. Love, ?" He watched intently as Sonia opened it that evening and feigned amazement, delight, then utter bafflement as to the identity of her admirer. "Have you any idea who it might be, Daniel?" He pursed his lips and shrugged with his palms turned outward at the bottom of his skinny arms, trying not to smile. For weeks, Sonia kept the card on the mantelpiece in her bedroom. It was the question mark that made her laugh every time she looked at it. When Jacques came back from work, he took to asking her, "How are you, my love? And how is Monsieur question mark? How is little Herr Fragezeichen?" As for Sonia, what she felt for the child was beyond words, and she did not really care to examine it. When he had saved with his own money to buy her a present, a useless embroidered purse, the pleasure of receiving it was so shot through with a sort of anguish at what it told of Daniel and of his view of her that the pleasure lasted only for an instant, and she experienced the charming gesture as a sort of memento mori. Likewise, when she went to kiss him goodnight, the last thing before she herself went to bed, she murmured words of utter devotion as she leaned over. As she kissed him and inhaled the smell of him, she felt her whole being shift in her guts and knew that this vertiginous lurch of feeling came about in her because she was really thinking what a short time he would remain a child. The nights could be numbered, and what a short life would be his on earth. In truth, it occurred to her, she was not kissing her child a happy good night. She was thinking of his death.
Thank you. It's very powerful, isn't it, that? And I can see it stirs something very deep in you.
Yes, I find this book almost overwhelming. And it is the character of Sonia, really. For me, she was the one that leapt off the page, and her experience, particularly of motherhood, being a wife. There's certain moments that I can think of, not least when my first daughter was 6 weeks old and I got on a plane and I went to America. And I remember gripping the seat for the first time in my life, thinking I was going to die in an air crash. And I'd been a perfectly confident flyer before then. And it was it's the sort of this sudden intensity of the importance of your life when you become a parent. And the love you experience for your child is something completely other.
When journalists write you up, They like that idea of the sort of the super mum opera star, don't they? This is always part of the story. You know, Ian Bostridge has children. Nobody ever congratulates him for having an opera career as well, do they? How do you feel about that?
Yes, well, I mean, it is the modern conundrum, isn't it, for a woman, whether you choose to pursue a career. Actually, a musical career is tremendously combinable with a family because we don't have the fixed hours. You can do a bit of pick and choose in advance which work you do take. I'm absolutely passionate about both things. I'm incredibly lucky that the two streams of my life are both passions.
And yet I have heard musicians say, I won't name any of them, well, you've got to choose one or the other.
I'm sure that certain people believe that. I don't feel that I've shortchanged either one, but you can never live a different life, so who knows where I would have gone with singing if I hadn't had children. I certainly have no regrets.
Let's move on to your next reading, which I think you may have chosen for small people beyond this room. What's this?
This is David Walliams, and it's Billionaire Boy. Now, I could have chosen any of his books because they're marvellous, and I do lots of reading to my kids at bedtime. And some of the books trip off your tongue easier than others, and these are fantastic. These are so beautiful to read, and they're funny for adults as well as children, and they are shot through with ideas of moral messages.
There's something
messages.
We need to know before we hear Andrew read from this, isn't there?
Yes, you need to know what bum fresh is. Bum fresh is an invention of Mr. Spud, who is Joe's father. He worked in a factory, a toilet roll factory, for many, many years, and eventually came up with the idea of a double-sided toilet roll, one which moisturises your bottom.
Fresh bum, this is called.
Is it fresh bum? Wrong way round, there you go.
Andrew.
When Mr. Spud finally launched Fresh Bum, it was an instant phenomenon. Mr. Spud sold 1 billion rolls around the world every day. And every time a roll was sold, he made 10p. It all added up to an awful lot of money, as this simple maths equation shows. 10p times 1 billion rolls times 365 days a year equals a lot of wonga. Soon, father and son moved out of their pokey council flat and into an enormous stately home. Mr. Spud named it Fresh Bum Towers. The house was so large, it was visible from outer space. It took 5 minutes just to motor up the drive. Hundreds of newly planted, hopeful little trees lined the mile-long gravel track. The house had 7 kitchens, 12 sitting rooms, 47 bedrooms, and 89 bathrooms. Even the bathrooms had ensuite bathrooms. And some of those ensuite bathrooms had ensuite bathrooms. Can I have a proper present as well, Dad? Said Joe as he put the check in his trouser pocket. I mean, I've got loads of money already. Tell me what you want, son, and I'll get one of my assistants to buy it, said Mr. Spud. Some solid gold sunglasses? I've got a pair. You can't see out of them, but they're very expensive. Joe yawned. Your own speedboat, ventured Mr. Spud. Joe rolled his eyes. I've got 2 of those, remember? Sorry, son. How about £250,000 worth of W.H. Smith vouchers? Boring, boring, boring! Joe stamped his feet in frustration. Here was a boy with high-class problems. Joe suddenly had a thought. He pictured himself going round the racetrack all on his own, racing against himself. Well, there is something I really want, he said tentatively. Name it, son, said Mr. Spud. A friend.
Thank you. In a way, it's quite a traditional story, isn't it? Because it has this kind of the moral imperative of those early children's stories.
They are, yeah, no, they're absolutely. They're incredibly well done, though. They're sort of not, because you get a lot of propaganda within the education system when your kids bring home, you know, 5 a day fruit and veg homework and, you know, go running, be active homework, and everything sort of has a message from school. So you come to a book like this, and the fact that the message that he's making is so skillfully handled and so entertainingly portrayed that it's a pleasure as an adult to follow it, but certainly the kids just swept away by it.
How does the fact that you're a performer affect the way that you read to your children? I mean, do you give it everything?
I suppose you'd have to ask them. I occasionally become a little bit self-conscious and think, did I deliver that well enough? But no, I mean, it's great because I love doing it. I love doing it. So, and I think they feel that. They know it.
None of the herons that you played ever start kind of leeching into your private life, do you? Do they? The operatic mode never takes over, does it?
No, I'm very good at doing a role and leaving it behind. Yeah, very good.
Okay. Well, that's where we have to close the book now, unfortunately. My thanks to Andrew Wincott for reading for us today and to Christine Rice. Thank you for sharing your literary passions.
Thank you.
Matthew Sweet presented this evening's Proms Plus Literary event, and the producer was Luke Mulhall. And this is Petroc Trelawney welcoming you back to the Royal Albert Hall, where this Saturday night prom features the London Philharmonic Orchestra under principal conductor Vladimir Yurovsky. To finish, the orchestra play a late 19th century masterwork, Tchaikovsky's Manfred Symphony, written in 1885, inspired by Byron's dramatic poem telling of a tormented man deeply anguished by his shaming behaviour in the past, now wandering tortured through the Alps. The critic Vladimir Stasov and the composer Milya Balakirev provided a very detailed synopsis for Tchaikovsky to work from. It's outlined in the programme for tonight's concert, which you can view online right now at bbc.co.uk/proms. Well, when I spoke to Vladimir Yurovsky earlier on, he told me how Manfred was a work the orchestra have become very familiar with.
It's one of those pieces which, unless the orchestra knows it inside out, creates almost insuperable problems technically and musically, because the structure is completely different from any other Tchaikovsky symphony. It's more of a laboratory of a composer, it's a workshop of a composer who is experimenting, alone the amount of extra instruments, organ, two harps, bass clarinet, cor anglais, a huge percussion section. That alone makes it for a theatrical piece.
And you've extended the strings.
And I've extended the strings following the Russian tradition of the 20th century. I mean, the impact which the amount of strings, 18 first violins, give to this music is absolutely unique. And we know that Tchaikovsky has always insisted to have as many strings as physically possible.
It's clearly something of a signature piece for you, because you've been doing it with the orchestra for nearly a decade. You recorded it back in 2004. Generally, it's not performed as often as the numbered symphonies. What is it that attracts you about it?
I inherited the love for this piece from two conductors, from my father and from Gennady Rozhdestvensky, who I think was the first conductor to discover the similarities between this Tchaikovsky and Stravinsky, the neoclassical Stravinsky. Tchaikovsky used this piece as a pretext to experiment with different textures and with the different type of symphonism, much more theatrical type of symphonism, which at the same time led into the neoclassical 20th century. And if you listen carefully, there are segments of the symphony which already remind you of the later works of Tchaikovsky, the Sixth Symphony, Nutcracker, the Queen of Spades. All the later masterpieces are already contained, like in a nutshell, in this Manfred.
Vladimir Yurovsky, who now conducts the London Philharmonic Orchestra in Tchaikovsky's Manfred. Thank you.
Thank you.